the title, provocative as always, Everything You Know About Password Stealing Is Wrong, which sounds like it might be a bit of a stretch and a generalization, but I don't think it's that much. So if I'm going to make a statement like that, what do we actually know about password stealing and cybercrime, and how do we know it? And I would argue that a lot of what we know and what we think we know comes from stuff like this. It's reports that we see in the New York Times and from things like Symantec and Business Week, and fairly casual, not very scientific, not peer-reviewed kind of stuff, telling us that cybercrime is huge, it's large, it's growing, that that criminals in whatever your favorite jurisdiction, or part of the world to pick on is, harvest money at will from the online population. Essentially, we are powerless before this, ever-growing onslaught. So stuff like this, black market and credit card thrives on the web, the underground economy priceless. Even those without great skills can barter their way into large quantities of money that they would never earn in the physical world, and stuff like this. Symantec looks at the underground economy and claims that it's worth $5.3 billion. Gartner says phishing is $3.2 billion and stuff like that. And it's always big and it's always growing. A report from, I think it was it Norton last year, said that cybercrime last year cost $388 billion. And of course it's growing. That's the that's what we're given to understand here. And what I want to persuade you of is this is all wrong. It's just all wrong. There's just no shred of truth in this whatsoever. And that what we think we know is based on factoids, poorly sourced stuff, confirmation bias, and junk science, I would say, or stuff that doesn't even qualify as science, or as Pauling would say, in the most dismissive thing you can say about something, it's not even wrong. It doesn't even make a firm statement that that you can rely on. And so the outline of what I'm going to try to take you through is consumers are not liable for losses when funds are stolen from their accounts, and that's kind of a fact that has kind of seeped out there, but I don't think people have really thought through the implications of it. There's profound implications for what goes on in cybercrime and what doesn't go on. That emptying accounts is extremely hard. Passwords are not the bottleneck. They're nowhere near being the bottleneck in the cybercrime pipeline. Underground markets, no matter what you've heard, are not thriving, quite the reverse. Credential stealing, far from being a frictionless, recession-proof business, is actually a terrible business. It's about as bad as a business as you can imagine constructing. And the cybercrime estimates that you've seen saying $380 billion and $250 billion and $1 trillion and stuff like that are just junk. They're just, they are entirely, they're entirely worthless. So that's what I'm going to try to do. That's my plan. And so, as you might have, my style is I try to provoke people. So, people, if you feel I've provoked the rage in you, by all means, get up and give vent to your spirit, and we can hack it out, right? So let me start with consumers are not liable for losses. There was a story about a year ago where the FBI director Robert Mueller was banned by his wife from doing online banking after he nearly fell for a phishing scam. No more internet banking for you, she said. And now I hate to sort of insinuate that the director of the FBI doesn't know what he's doing, but he doesn't really know what he's doing, in the sense that consumers are protected. Even if somebody steals your password, and even if they successfully remove money from your account, you are not going to end up holding the loss for that. And that's not because banks are nice guys. There's US Federal Reserve Regulation E limits user liability to $50 for any electronic transfer that is initiated through an electronic terminal, telephone, computer, or magnetic tape. And interestingly, there's a rider to the regulation that says consumer negligence is expressly ruled out as a mechanism for a bank to increase consumer liability. The bank cannot argue that the consumer was negligent and therefore his liability is greater than the $50. It says, thus consumer behavior that may constitute negligence under state law, such as writing down the PIN on a debit card or a piece of paper kept with the card, does not affect the consumer's liability for unauthorized transfers. Basically, if money is taken out by Federal Reserve regulation, the bank has to make you whole. And that's not that's not just written in some abstruse regulation which is not enforced. You go to the online you know, security and protection pages of any of the large banks, and here are a few. Bank of America says our zero liability guarantee, for example, guarantees zero liability for any authorized activity originating from online banking or bill pay. I mean, that goes beyond the $50 liability. Wells Fargo says, we guarantee that you'll be covered for 100% of funds removed from your Wells Fargo account in the unlikely event, you know, blah, blah, blah. Fidelity, we will reimburse your Fidelity account for any losses due to unauthorized activity. HSBC, similar thing, basically. Even things that are not regarded as traditional banks, PayPal, which, you know, you might be able to argue, or maybe they might be able to argue is not a bank, you know, goes above and beyond and says, no, yes, we're going to abide by that. They say, we voluntarily reimburse consumers for all financial losses from transactions not authorized by the consumer, not just losses above $50, and that's in their 10K filing. And this, you know, and it's not, I mean, the consumer protections in the U.S. are actually very, very good. But this is, you know, by no means is this, you know, the only case. In the EU, there's a directive which limits consumer liability to 150 euros. Canada has a zero liability law also, although the stuff around consumer negligence is a little less generous. So the point I want to make here is, at least in the U.S., and I'm kind of talking more or less exclusively about consumer password accounts in the United States, but it's, you know, that's a large enough case to be interesting, and it certainly kind of, you know, begs the question about other problem subspaces. But the idea that consumers suffer irreversible financial harm is just incorrect. It's just incorrect. There is no basis to this whatsoever. If somebody steals your money out of your account, you get the money back from the bank, unless basically You're complicit in the theft. Now, why is this? Why is this? I mean, this fact has been remarked before, and it kind of occasionally floats up, and people kind of, you know, notice it and pass by it. But I think that this fact holds the key to a lot of what is going on, and it holds the key to confirming many of the kind of outlandish and provocative claims I said I was going to try to establish at the start. And I, you know, this isn't there because banks are nice guys and they just want to take care of people. That's not the case at all. And I want to argue that it's the case because banks realize something very fundamental that a lot of people in security have a difficulty wrapping their heads around. Banks realize that fear is bad for business. It's bad for pretty much every business except the security business. And that's why maybe security people don't understand the fact. There was an interesting, a very, very telling, maybe it was only telling to me because it stuck in my head, and maybe it isn't as telling to other people. But about 3 years ago in Seattle, it was a very interesting incident. A guy walked into a bank and he said, this is a holdup. He didn't have a gun, he didn't show a gun. He just put his hand in his pocket in an ambiguous fashion. He said, this is a stick up, give me the money. And the teller said, I don't believe you, show me the gun. And the guy mumbled something and blah, 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 there was some confusion. And the guy panicked, he didn't have a gun, he panicked, he ran out of the bank. And the teller jumped over the counter, ran out of the bank after him, pursued the guy for 3 blocks, knocked him down, pinned him down, held him there until the police got there. Now what's interesting is what happens next. The bank fires the teller. Why did the bank fire the teller? Because they say, and they make very explicit, they say, if someone comes into our bank and threatens, you know, in any way, claims to be armed, and asks for the money, we give them the money. That's our policy. The bank doesn't want a brawl. They don't want a firefight. They don't want the perception that they valued money more than anybody's safety. So they fired the teller. They understand that fear is bad for business. And they understand a couple of other things. One, fear is bad for business. Getting money and keeping money are not the same thing. They also realize that, you know, the response time of the police in the downtown area is about 3 minutes, and leaving a bank on foot with a, you know, bag of swag is having been captured on 20 cameras is not it's not as easy to get away with as you think. And the third thing that they understand, and I think this is where I think it links to Regulation E, is banks understand non-repudiation. Banks have understood non-repudiation for hundreds of years, actually, long before the importance of the idea ever occurred to any of us. And by the way, if just as an aside, I mean, KeyBank, I don't think it's a supranational chain, but they actually publicized this business of, if you make a threat, we give you the money. And if you're interested, there is a KeyBank. It's about a block up to the north on the, you say, go out the front, that's Bellevue Way, up, and it's on your left. You might want to take your badge off before you And don't all go at once, obviously. I want to argue, banks understand non-repudiation. They understand it very well. And a consequence of that, a consequence of Regulation E, or is that emptying accounts armed only with a password is very hard. And let me show you why. Let me get some water first. When a guy gets a, like the guy who ran into that key bank, what does he want? He wants money. Well, that's not all that he wants. He wants money, and he wants to, getting money is easy, as we said. You walk in and you say, have your gun, they give you money. He doesn't just want money. He wants to get money, and he wants to keep money, and he wants to not go to jail. That's what he wants. And see, the first part is easy, the second part is slightly hard. So he gets nothing. I mean, getting money is easy. If you've got if you've got someone's password, well, you don't get any money if when you get in there you try to, transfer money out of the account and it gets detected and they don't make the transfer. You don't get any money if it gets detected. But you also don't get any money if it's reversed. If there's a way for the bank to roll the transaction back after you transfer it somewhere else. And you also, it's kind of less of a barrier, but you also don't get any money if it's traced all the way to you in a jurisdiction where someone can get their hands on you and arrest you. So what you really need is, you need a way with the password. If I steal your password, I want to get into your account and I want to transfer money out, but I have to do it in a way that can't be reversed and can't be traced. Now it sounds like that ought to be simple, but no, it's not. Now suppose it is simple. Suppose, given a password, I can go into someone's account and, great, there's $9,000 there, and I can just transfer the $9,000 out in a way that is irreversible and untraceable. Well, a consequence of Regulation E is now that banks have no protection whatsoever against self-theft, meaning that first-party fraud is a giant gaping hole in their system. For example, Alice has a bank account. She puts her life savings in there. Then she opens another account and in an irreversible, untraceable way transfers her life savings. And then she calls the bank and says, what up? I've been robbed. Please make me whole under Regulation E. If you can do this in an untraceable, irreversible way, then the bank has this enormous, gigantic hole, which is all of their online banking, represents a conduit through which money can flow out, and they've got no way of blocking it. Well, and in other words, their entire customer base, who already have the password, who don't have to steal the password, represent this gigantic, gigantic hole. Well, this only works if the transaction can't be traced or reversed. So your transaction must be untraceable and irreversible. But this is hard in the banking system. I mean, Bank Secrecy Act and the US Patriot Act, there's a lot of provisions in there against money laundering. It's not easy to just go in and set up a John Doe account. It's not easy to, yes? I'm talking just about consumers here. I'll touch on a little later, but I mean, mostly consumers are what I'm talking about. It's significantly, remind me in a little bit, and I'll try to touch on it a bit. So the transaction must be irreversible and untraceable. Now, so the problem is that I can get in, I can see the money, I can do all sorts of stuff, but if I can't transfer it out in an irreversible, untraceable way, what am I going to do? Well, Butler Lamson made this, amusing quip, all problems in computer science can be solved by another layer of indirection. And that's actually what, phishers and people who steal passwords actually do. They say, well, I can't get money out in an irreversible, untraceable way unless I get someone to do it for me, which is the role that mules play in this cybercrime, cash laundering operation, which is, I steal a password and I go to, that gets me into the account and it'll allow me to, you can transfer stuff, you can, make payments and all that kind of thing, but you can't get things out in a way that is irreversible and untraceable. But what you can do is you can transfer it in a way that is reversible and traceable to someone else, who we call a mule, and then get him to voluntarily transfer in a way that is irreversible and untraceable. And that's the role of a mule, basically. What he does is he accepts a bad transfer and he initiates a good one. It's basically he's in the business of accepting checks that will ultimately bounce and writing good ones or giving cash in return. So, I mean, this is basically, to pillage account, I go in, transfer to this guy, and then get him to transfer 90% of the funds, that is, you know, the money minus the commission, to me. And so the mule, why is this irreversible and untraceable? Well, this guy is not using the same transfer path as can be enabled with the password here. This is why mule transfers are done using things like Western Union, virtual gold, and many and things like that. So if there's any tracing going to be done, it's going to trace only to the mule. If there's going to reversing is going to be done, it's going to reverse only from the mule. And so these mule schemes are, I mean, mule recruitment are often these work at home type schemes where there's a story about being a reshipping agent for some Eastern European country company or something like that. And they often come with, they're given a semi-plausible reason to process transactions. They receive funds from a victim account, which they believe is a payment to this, you know, company that they're representing. They send funds to the attacker in a Western Union type transaction. They get 10 or 20% commission. We'll see how that works out in a second. And they never actually meet their employer. Of course, it's all online. They use only cash and unstoppable transfers. And urgency is a very common theme, right? I mean, because the clock is ticking as soon as a transfer is recognized as being fraudulent, they're going to stop, block the rest of anything else leaving that account, and they're going to try to initiate reversal. So they want the money. They want the money moving as quickly as possible. So as I say, when the transaction is traced, it traces as far as the mule. That's it. You know, the mule will have, you know, a Western Union office to which he transferred something. That's effectively all it is. When it's reversed, it reverses from the mule. So anything that the mule has forwarded on is now the attacker's to keep. So let's look at that. Let's look at that in slow motion. Let's look at who ends up with what at what stage in the transaction. Suppose a phisher steals a password, gets into an account, and let's say, you know, $10,000 for the sake of argument from a victim account. So before discovery, you know, the victim is down $10,000. That's been transferred out. The bank is kind of neutral in this. They're just, you know, processing transactions. The mule is up $1,000 because that's his commission. That's what he keeps. And he sent irreversibly and untraceably $9,000 to the attacker. After discovery, the bank says, whoops, that transfer was no good. So $10,000 comes back from your account, and too bad that you forwarded $9,000 of it on to someone else. So the victim is made whole. The bank is again just a conduit in this transaction. The attacker is up $9,000, and guess who's down $9,000? I mean, the mule is down precisely the amount of money that the attacker is up. So when you look at it this way, it's like, well, the attacker isn't stealing from the victim account at all. He's stealing from the mule. That fact doesn't become obvious until the dust settles. But that's actually what's going on here, right? The bank isn't going to end up down money. They don't take, you know, risk for which they've not been compensated. There's a chance if the mule has already, may not have the funds to cover this. And, you know, banks, I think, they're not unfamiliar with the nature of counterparty risk and someone not being able to. I mean, effectively, when you get a $10,000 transfer, and you transfer $9,000 of it out, the bank understands rather well that until 90 days are up and any possibility of that transaction being rolled back is gone, that effectively what they're giving you is a signature-free loan. They understand that, you know, someone who has no history of having large funds in their account, transferring money out means that they're exposed if something goes wrong. So it is the mule, not the victim who ends up down here. And the whole thing about why was the password, so if I'm really stealing from the mule, well, why did I need the password of this guy to begin with? Well, that was essentially the piece of theater that was necessary to create, you know, for the mule, the story by which he would give me money and not get anything in return. This here was just a cover story. That money is, it's the mule's money that you're really going after. And this is, what I want to claim here is that banks understand non-repudiation. And if you look at all the set of things that you can do at your bank, at your retail bank, you know, there's some things that you can do with passwords, and there are some things for which you require, many people in security express the frustration that, you know, banks don't understand two-factor. Well, you know, have you tried getting money from an ATM recently? Well, they understand quite well that if they're going to give you cash, that you have to go, you have to have a card, you have to have the PIN, and there's a camera on it also. If you go into a bank branch, the last time I went into my retail bank branch, I counted 23 cameras in the space. So if I go in and I try to take cash out, and then come in the next day and say, no, that wasn't me, that was someone else, you gave my money to the wrong person. Well, you know, there's a forensic trail. I might not be able to catch the bad transaction as it happens, but if there's first party fraud, I've got enough information that I can detect it. So if you look at what you can do with a password at your bank, you know, you can do electronic transfers, you can do, you know, things that are effectively like checks. But these things can always be repudiated. Anything you can do with a password can be repudiated. Why do I say that? Well, because passwords are stolen all the time. You're living under a rock, you know, if you don't realize that people can come afterwards and say, no, that wasn't me. But the things that are non-reversible, you want to get cash at an ATM? No, you can't do that with a password. You want to do a Western Union transfer? Not without going in and signing forms. And as a matter of fact, if you go in and you say, I want to initiate Western Union transfers for my account, they show you a sheet of paper explaining the Nigerian fraud scam and various other things and tell you about the danger. I mean, they will agree to do it, but they will not agree. Anything that you can do that is non-reversible will not be covered under Regulation E. They are expressly going to make sure that you understand and give up your rights to be compensated if the repudiation, which they can no longer, if you now have the right to repudiate, you don't have the right to reverse. Yes, I think I got that right. And the sketch of the proof, that nothing, and I can't claim that, okay, every single possible thing in every single bank, you know, that you can do with a password that I've verified that it's non-reversible. But the sketch of the proof that there's nothing that you can do meaningful at a bank that is reversible and repudiable is given by the fact that the U.S. banking system handles on the order of 100 million electronic transfers and checks and various transactions of that kind per day. And so if you do something where it can be repudiated and there's a way of, you know, getting money out irreversibly and doing first-party fraud, whenever you do 100 million of anything a day, you know, anything that can go wrong does go wrong, and it goes wrong many times. And you're going to get to see it and learn from it very, very quickly. That's my argument that passwords are, you know, they're not nothing, but they're very far from being the keys to the kingdom. They're very far from being the last line of defense. And banks really show some understanding of this if you look for how they conduct their business. So what I want to argue is that, you know, contrary to popular belief and contrary to a lot of the investment of effort that we see, passwords are not the bottleneck. They're very far from being the thing which, when lost, compromises everything. Stealing passwords is a part of the cybercrime pipeline, but it's by no means the most important part, and the mule recruitment, which is actually, as I say, you're stealing from the mule, not from the victim, actually looks to be a far more important thing. So, I mean, again, this data is, you know, now kind of getting into the realm of, you know, things that are slightly anecdotal. But, you know, Krebs on his blog, and he's kind of, you know, studied this probably more than most. Claims that most money mules get a single transfer before the trigger gets hit and somebody causes an alert and the bank stops allowing them to transfer stuff. Cisco, in their annual security report, which is not the, I would not offer as a as um, a flawless source of information, but they claim somewhat hyperbolically that the ratio of stolen credentials to mule capacity could be as high as 10,000 to 1. In other words, you know, there's a lot of people stealing a lot of passwords. Stealing passwords is not particularly, you know, it's not particularly hard. Getting, you know, those passwords and turning them into money is extraordinarily hard. And mules appear to be the bottleneck of it, because you need to find people who are dumb enough to sign up for this deal where they're going to, you know, basically accept checks that are going to bounce and give you cash in return. Effectively, that's what. And, you know, recruiting and running mules is very, very, very high touch. I mean, it's a very, you actually have to, you know, you have to recruit these people, you have to find them, you have to cajole them, you have to give them a plausible story. And how shall I put this diplomatically? I mean, many of these people, you know, live in the long tail of the economic distribution. I mean, you know, there are very few, you know, billionaires and millionaires who sign up for stuff like this. So you're dealing with people who, you know, cannot necessarily be counted on to, you know, carry through their instructions flawlessly and expeditiously and stuff like that. So recruiting and running mules is a very high touch, difficult proposition. So, and if mules are the bottleneck, then it means, you know, passwords are definitely not. I mean, stealing passwords is definitely easy. Cashing out is definitely hard. So, which leads to, you know, an oversupply of credentials on the underground economy. In other words, suppose there's a certain number of passwords being stolen every year, and but cashing them out, transferring those stolen passwords into money, is the hard part. Then, as a thought experiment, suppose we reduce by a factor of 2 the number of passwords that are stolen. What effect does that have on the ultimate harm experienced at the end of the pipeline? Does it reduce, you know, harm by a factor of 2? Probably not, almost certainly not. I mean, if you've got a giant lake of passwords that are being drained through a very narrow pipe of mules, you can decrease the inflow into that lake to an enormous degree and have pretty much no effect whatever on the ultimate outflow. So what I'm arguing essentially is that, well, passwords and a lot of the emphasis that we've placed on them as though passwords are insecure, true, not new information, but true, and therefore, you know, U.S. banks don't know what they're doing and and cybercrime is billions of dollars a year. This seems not to be the case, and if you take the cascade of the two systems, let's say the technical system which tries to prevent passwords being stolen as this block, and then the block that follows it, the system of trying to prevent stolen passwords from being monetized. I think what seems to be emerging is that, you know, we all know that we have failed utterly in the first block. We have failed utterly in securing the password system. We have failed utterly in preventing passwords from being stolen. But it seems to be that things are succeeding rather well in the business of preventing stolen passwords from being monetized. And further, it seems that throwing resources into the part that's failing is not necessarily a very smart thing. Meaning that we're having true success in the downstream blocks of preventing the harm, which presumably is the ultimate goal. Now, so that's one or two of the blocks in the provocative list of things that that I threw up there. And by the way, you know, you're all being, you know, very, maybe I'm just being too provocative and you've given up, or maybe I'm not being provocative enough. I sometimes lose calibration. So just on the question that Niels asked on, you know, is this, I mean, a logical question is, yes, but this is just, you know, US consumer stuff. And that's, you know, absolutely true. And there's been a lot of, Krebs again has documented a lot of, you know, theft and stuff from small businesses. And there are a number of reasons why, you know, small businesses are not covered by the same consumer protections. But, I mean, the consumer protection, I mean, the fact that banks, I mean, I've used Regulation E to argue that the fact that banks feel comfortable giving that level of guarantee to consumers who they don't even know or trust, essentially, you know, means that they have better tools than many of us imagine to catch and detect fraud downstream. There are a number of reasons why they probably don't do that in the business-to-business arena, and the losses there genuinely probably are considerably higher. The main reason, I think, is that if money is stolen out of my account, the main thing that the bank has to figure out is this first-party fraud or not? And they're basically, you know, it's not simple, but there's a certain amount of legwork necessary to figure out, is this guy complicit in stealing his money? Has he, you know, what account did it transfer into? Is it someone with the same last name or someone in the same city or stuff like that? With small companies, it's a lot more complicated. If you've got a small company that's 50 people, well, now there's 50 people who are potentially complicit in the fraud, and you really, it's a much more difficult thing to check into. But, and small, one thing that is, you know, makes detection of fraud in the business space a lot more complex is that your average consumer retail checking account doesn't do a great deal of transfers, right? You know, it pays bills to utility companies and credit cards and stuff like that. It doesn't do a lot of, you know, wiring money to complete strangers all over the place. A small business, you know, an auto parts shop or something like that, probably has a lot of transfers going on every day, and it's a lot harder to detect fraud in that space. So definitely, I think that's where the money is definitely bigger, and it's a much harder problem to plug. It's still orders of magnitude smaller than some of the figures you've seen mentioned, but it's sure.
So that was the detection part. You might also argue that the reversibility doesn't apply the same way to, you know, ACH via fraud.
No, I think the reversibility rules are kind of the same in that, you know, banks do attempt to reverse transactions that they believe to be fraudulent. But in the consumer space, there's a very clear set of responsibility around, well, even if you can't reverse it, even if you can't get the money back from the other bank, you still must make this consumer whole. Banks and the fact that banks agreed to Regulation E, technically it's a regulation written by the government, but if you assume that the banks write the regulations that they give to the government to agree to, it's just a way more complex process, right? Catching the fraud, you know, for small businesses is just way more difficult, which is, I think, why they won't agree to it.
Okay, perhaps based on this slide, perhaps a bad example would be Max Butler. You don't know him?
No.
There's a whole book written about him by Kevin Paulson, Kingpin. He decided he was going to corner the market on stolen credit cards. And so he had made millions of dollars before he got caught, and not everybody in his group was caught. So, but what he did is essentially, he was a carder, and he ran a carding forum, and then he hacked another carding forum and took over that carding forum.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, at one area, your point is really valid. I mean, most credit cards are worth like 10 or 25 cents on the black market. That's what your credit card. If it's like some fancy American Express card, it might be worth $5. So, but there is real money. There is a black market. These guys have actually studied it.
So I'm actually was about to start talking about some underground market stuff. And no, absolutely, the claim is not, you know, between zero and infinity, there's a lot of difference.
Yeah, there's a huge gap.
And there's, you know, like many human endeavors, right? There's you know, a long tail distribution of capability, and
right.
You know, and people often sort of produce anecdotes like this, where what about this guy who made blah 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 $5 million before he was caught? It's like, mm-hmm. Well, first of all, it's $5 million, is not a billion, right? So to get from 5 million to a billion. You know, you need quite a few.
Or a guy who is arrested in the San Francisco airport in the smoking lounge after exchanging a CD with 100,000 credit card numbers on it for $70,000. But it was a sting. But, you know, so those things do happen. And $70,000, I mean, you can live okay on that for a year. So
no, absolutely.
It's money. It's not like it's no
absolutely.
Money.
It's money. But, you know, to get from, and I think when you start to, I mean, when you say numbers like $70,000, it sounds very, very realistic to me. Mm-hmm. But when you say, okay, so if cybercrime is, you know, as the NSA director said, $1 trillion a year, well, how many $70,000 CDs does it take to get to a trillion?
No,
it's a lot.
I am not going to argue. I don't want to say there's no money in it. That's all.
I think that for many of the people who make money in it, mm-hmm. they probably are, you know, at the very head of the distribution, they may be doing well, but you know, very quickly below the top 1% by income are probably not even making what they could make from a minimum wage job in whatever jurisdiction they live in.
Oh yeah, like drug dealing.
Like drug dealing. Yeah. It's a multi-level market. Yes.
So I'm as skeptical of the $1 trillion, you know, crazy number, you know, made up cyber numbers as anybody, but and you've convinced me in this talk that, you know, I should not quit my day job as a computer science professor and go into the more lucrative field of running Mule. So I appreciate that career advice, but I wonder if you're using the wrong set of numbers to refute this, right? I mean, you've convinced us that extracting the kinds of money from crime, that are being talked about, is so wildly implausible to be laughable. But that doesn't say that they aren't doing a zillion dollars worth of damage along the way to get there, right? I mean, so for example, the cost of having a credit card compromised, you know, is easily $50 worth of hassle, right? Even if I'm not actually reimbursing the credit card company for it.
Preach it, brother, preach it. I mean, that's exactly the point, is that, you know, this is, I mean, in economics, this is what's called, you know, the broken window syndrome, is right, you know, is that when people have, you know, when a part of town has got broken windows and graffiti all over the place and it looks unkempt and disheveled, it has a depressing effect on, you know, the economic vitality of the region. And the amounts of money that people are making from spam and phishing are orders and orders of magnitude below the numbers that have been tossed around and that have kind of been nodded along with. The damage that it is doing is enormous, right? But we've been focusing, I think, on the wrong part of the problem.
So if we give these people a better conversion rate, will we see less crime?
Give them a better conversion rate.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't think it works that way. Because I mean,
To try anything. So,
well, something I'll get to in a couple of slides is, you know, when there's no barrier to entry in a business, right? You know, when you have an open market resource, right? If you know, injecting money into the thing doesn't raise the boats of everybody in there, it just attracts more and more and more people in there. You know, putting more fish into the Atlantic, you know, doesn't really, you know, it just attracts more fishermen, right? I don't think there's a simple fix like that. But I think you're precisely right, that the economics of how to, I mean, if you think that people are making billions, then if you can cut off the profit stream, it's actually, well, maybe they'll go away. If they're used to making billions, but if they're doing it and they're causing all this harm and they're not even making any money, well, then it's a lot harder to apply economic incentives when economics is really not what's driving, you know, what's driving it to begin with.
So is part of the solution then maybe educating would-be hackers that they're going to be working for less than minimum wage and they should just get a job at McDonald's?
I think usually my wide-eyed philosophy, you know, part I reserve for the end of the talk, but maybe I got there a little early this time. I think educating them is definitely good. One thing that, you know, I mean, I personally feel very strongly on is that, you know, when we repeat poorly sourced arguments about how easy the money is in cybercrime, we do a lot of harm in that, you know, why do people do what they do? And I have a slide in a little bit that says, you know, well, a standard answer I get, maybe I've converted this crowd already and, you know, you're no fun, you just agree with me too easily, you all just rolled over. You know, an argument I often get is, you know, oh, but they wouldn't be doing it if they're not making a lot of money. Well, that's not true. There's a lot of, you know, everything from buying lottery tickets to, you know, gambling. There's a lot of things that people do where deterministically they just lose money time after time after time. They do it when you've got profound information asymmetry. People think that they're going to get money, or they think that they're going to get lucky, or they think they're doing something wrong, and if they keep with it. And I don't want to, well, I guess I am mentioning names, but when people waft these enormous, There's long been a taboo in the, say, antivirus community about people who work on the white hat side, you know, writing rootkits and doing things like that, because, well, that would be kind of, you know, writing vulnerabilities here and doing the patch there, you're kind of keeping yourself in business. It's like, well, okay, that's a good taboo. But I think it would be worth considering whether when people like Symantec and Norton waft out trillion-dollar estimates that really are, you know, statistically as good as, you know, write down your phone number and call it an estimate, right? That really attracts people into the business and having, making it sound worse than it is definitely not in anybody's good except for the people who are making money selling solutions, right? So I do have more slides, but yes.
Oh, I just had to mention there was actually a guy named Klaus who had a company called ISS, and one of his employees actually created the vulnerability that they very quickly produced a scanner that could detect it. So that has happened, and yes, they security company did make money doing this. Sort of this sleazy company, but it did happen.
Yeah, I mean it. I mean, one thing, I mean, the point that Matt raised is absolutely correct, is that, a lot of the harm done is not the money extracted. Like Regulation E says, you know, if money is stolen out of your account, your bank will make you whole. Regulation E does not say that, you know, you're not going to spend, you know, hours upon hours on the phone with the bank persuading them that it wasn't you. They don't say it's going to be hassle-free or anything like that. They don't say any of those things, right? It's going to be, it could be a real mess. So that's I think, where the real harm for consumers lies and maybe for businesses also. But, and it's worth carefully considering, you know, who is to blame exactly how much for all of that. So kind of on the underground market stuff a little bit, I think that this helps explain also the, you know, well, why do credentials sell for pennies on the dollar? Which is, you know, that's another of the things that we sort of know about cybercrime. Well, there's exciting underground markets and there's, you know, things are, you know, buying and selling. And one piece of information that always struck me as very anomalous is that in every one of the reports I would see, there are these reports that credit cards are selling for pennies on the dollar. And, you know, Symantec said, well, credit cards sell for 50 cents. Team Kumru said, you know, $500 asking price for credentials that had a face value of $10 million. Franklin et al., probably the best study of this kind of stuff, saw hundreds of free credit cards per day floating by on a single channel. And the explanations that people offer for this kind of stuff is, you know, well, Symantec, you know, said that, you know, more supply drives the price down. Now, that sounds like something that might be true. It's like, well, no, but more supply drives price down when demand can't keep up, right? I mean, the demand for free money is pretty robust. I mean, it sounds like this makes sense, but it doesn't. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Team Kumru offered the explanation that, well, volume sellers don't care. He says, you know, this guy is selling credit cards and he's selling credentials for pennies on the dollar because he's got so many, he just doesn't care. He's just making so much money. Really? I mean, a volume seller doesn't care? I mean, ExxonMobil is what I would describe as a volume seller of oil. I mean, you think you're going to get ExxonMobil to sell you oil at $46 a barrel when the price is 47? No, I mean, volume sellers are in a better position than anyone to extract the absolute maximum amount of value from their product, and they don't give anything to anyone for free. I mean, no one sells gold, you know, for the price of silver. So the reason that these things are selling for 50 cents on the dollar, and actually, by the way, sell is not the right verb here, are being offered for sale at that price, is that that's an upper bound on what they're worth. There's no way that there's more. I mean, if someone could extract more value from that, from it, they would. The fact that they're selling it to you means that they can't. So one thing, again, I hate to sound like a cracked record in some of this stuff, but I really like kind of, you know, we often have the sense from some of this information that sort of drifts in from various sources that we know more than we actually do. And that, well, we know that credit cards are selling for pennies on the dollar. No, not quite. We don't know that. In the published accounts where there's some kind of a methodology section that you can actually trust, at least at the time I put this slide deck together, which is about, this part was about a year ago, there were no observed transactions. What people had done was they'd gone to underground chat rooms and they observed people offering to sell and offering to buy, but for obvious reasons, do not observe transactions closing. So you don't know that anything is selling at that price. You know people are saying, I will sell you at this price, and maybe if you're willing to buy, they'll sell it to you at that. But you're not really observing that anything is actually... And you know, the offers to sell on a number of these studies greatly outnumbered the offers to buy, which kind of implies that this is a buyer's market, not a seller, even at 50 cents on the dollar. And so that, given that you know, we're talking about you know, underground chat rooms where you know, participation is anonymous, it's scriptable, cheating is ubiquitous. I mean, we might have the impression that we know that we have reliable information here, but a way we'd like to think of it is this is kind of like net news without the quality control, right? This is just, you know, junk feeds of stuff who, you know, and, you know, it's safe to say none of us would take, you know, what we see on net news as being gospel. So this is a very poor source to form our impression of this enemy that we're fighting. So some of the studies that have looked at this kind of stuff, Thomas and Martin had an early study, Semantic. A lot of these things are industry reports. And one of the things that, you know, always struck me as very interesting is like, one, you know, things are selling for pennies on the dollar, but two, cheating appears to be ubiquitous. So that Thomas and Martin talk about these guys who are called rippers who, you know, basically, you know, take stuff from people and never pay or never perform. Franklin et al. Talks about these credit card numbers, you know, drifting across the wire. 22% of them don't even, you know, satisfy the loon checksum, which is, you know, they're 16-digit random numbers. They're not even really credit card numbers, even though they're presented as such. So, you know, and so on and so on and so. Yes.
Okay, I wanted to. This is Rick Farrow again. I just wanted to interrupt at this point. If just taking, you know, the premise seems to be this stuff is actually totally worthless. Because we never actually see.
No, what
you can't,
by stuff you mean?
Yeah, credit card numbers, for example, bank account information.
No, that's not the premise.
Okay, because obviously it must be worth something, or we wouldn't have so much activity in, surrounding it. Okay,
there's
activity.
Yes.
We do have people installing things that will collect credit card information. They yep. You know, they sell these to waiters yep. at restaurants, so you can yep. like surreptitiously collect the CC information. So there obviously it's worth something.
Credit card fraud
no
is...
No argument there.
There is no argument there. There is
okay.
credit card fraud. It exists.
Okay. Fine. I'll shut up.
Oh, okay. The claim is not that any of this is zero. The claim is that it's very hard to make money at this stuff.
Sure.
It's very... I mean, like I said, banks have been in the business of fighting fraud and money laundering for a long, long time. Credit card companies have been in the business of fighting credit card fraud for a long, long time. They understand, you know, they understand this stuff quite well. So the reason I want to, so is your question related or?
Yeah, related.
Sure, go ahead.
So I'd like to challenge on one point. First of all, you're assuming that detection happens, and maybe a way to prove this is how many people in this room still balance their checkbooks. So if a few people, but if nobody can detect the fraud, therefore they can't report the fraud, then how do we know?
Absolutely. And you know, there may be stuff where the argument that it's there, it's large, and we can't detect it because no one balances their checkbook is sort of, you know, well, this invisible stuff, we're seeing it more and more, right? It's everywhere, it's invisible, it's tasteless. If no one detects it, then, well, it must be small, right?
I don't know if that's true, though. That's my point. I mean, you can't measure it one way, you can't measure it the other way, right? You can't prove that, you know, right, I mean, you can't.
So, I mean, right? You know, I mean, if we, stars that defy observation are hard to reason about, right?
Sure.
If the argument is there is this phenomenon and it is like the luminiferous ether, it defies all forms of measurement and all forms of observation,
sure.
But yet it is there. I have a difficulty with this line of argument. I'm not saying that it's impossible. I'm not saying I can't disprove, you know, that something is large and yet we can't measure it. But,
right.
But you know, large claims require large evidence. And if the claim that, you know...
But there's a window of time in which the claim has to be made. And I think oftentimes people go back and, you know, your online transit, you know, you may only have online records back for 6 months.
Right.
And I think a lot of people, I think there are pretty, you know, at least people I know in the financial industry, they say, how many times have you had somebody come back and try to, sure. to dispute this
claim?
I mean,
it may be somewhat anecdotal, but it seems like, you know, the main path out of bank accounts rather than credit card numbers is through mules. And it seems like, you know, it's anecdotal. There hasn't been, you know, probably the best, you know, information on this stuff comes from Krebs's blog and kind of talking to those people. It seems like, you know, those tend to be large transactions, right? You know, if you the probability of getting one $10,000 transaction through is a lot higher than, you know, I mean, if you assume the if you assume a probability to detect of a given transaction, so do I have a better chance of getting to $10,000 doing a $10,000 transaction, which is a high chance of being caught? But I actually don't care that it's caught, so long as it's not caught before the mule gets my money out. Or doing $10,001 transactions. You're going to find it a lot more difficult to get the $1 transactions, I think, under reasonable assumptions of and running dollar transactions through a mule doesn't make a great deal of sense. So it's possible, but I'm not sure. So the reason I want to talk about this credit card stuff is, you know, it's yet another source of this kind of, you know, these gigantic numbers that, you know, just appear, you know, before us, and everybody kind of nods along, and so Symantec has one report on the underground economy and how, and said, you know, potential value of credit cards on one particular channel that they monitored over, I think it was a 9-month period, was $5.3 billion, which is, you know, nice big number, but just to, you know, illustrate the kind of, I mean, the looseness of the thinking that got them to this point is. Well, they observed a certain number of credit card, you know, being offered for sale. They didn't see anything actually sell. And the sum of the asking prices, which is, you know, there's no guarantee that any of this stuff sold, but the sum of the asking prices was $163 million, which is a very big number, but it's a much smaller number than $5.3 billion. So how did they get to $5.3 billion? Well, they assumed that, well, the fraud was not the, you know, the sum of the asking prices, but they went to an FTC average, which, you know, more on the FTC numbers a little bit later, and then they multiplied by the average fraud when fraud is successfully prosecuted, not when, you know, cards are stolen, but when fraud is successfully prosecuted, multiplied by that number. So the $5.3 billion comes from the sum of the asking prices multiplied by 32, basically. So just to unwrap for you in bullet form, the assumptions that they're making to get to that is that 100% of the goods that were offered for sale on this anonymous channel, which, as I say, is like net news without the quality control, 100% of goods sold at the asking price, that banks detect 0% of attempted fraud, that rippers, the people who are stealing stuff, account for 0% of sales, and that sellers give to buyers 30x return, meaning that, you know, the guy who stole the credit card stuff gives it to somebody else and say, hey, I'll take 3%, you take the 97%, call it good, you know, I'm a volume seller, I don't care. I think this just does not have the ring of truth to me. So, you know, is there anything else we could do with the same numbers, with the same observations? It's like, well, suppose that this stuff, you know, is more or less some flavor of the truth. Suppose buyers demand a 5x return. I'm not going to buy something from you and take the risk of doing all this stuff unless I get like a 5x premium on the money I put at risk. And suppose the final price is about 50% of the asking price. And assume that 10% of the offered credentials sell and are good, which is, you know, given that advertising is free, is not a bad thing. Well, then the total credit card fraud from these channels that they measured would come out to be $41 million, which again, I think is, you know, ridiculously on the high side. These are ridiculously generous estimates. But the factor difference between the number that Symantec floated at you, 128. I mean, and extrapolating from $0 in observed theft to $5.3 billion is a large extrapolation. And, you know, this is where we go a little bit wrong. So what I want to, let me move a teeny bit quicker here. Credential stealing is a terrible business. I mean, it sounds like it ought to be good, but it sounds like it ought to be good only because you haven't really considered it in a very careful way. It's like, you know, I don't really believe Matt has put a lot of thought into going over to the dark side. I mean, it's like, if you really start to think about it, yeah, could I give up my day job and do this? And so, the more you think about it, the more, I'm not so sure. And, you know, Charlie Munger, you know, the co-manager of Berkshire Hathaway says, well, we try to buy businesses with intrinsic durable competitive advantages. That's what he wants when he buys a business. That's what he wants when he slaps down his money. And, you know, if you look at credential stealing as a business, there's no intrinsic advantage for any one guy. If he has an advantage, it's never durable. And it is exactly the opposite of what Berkshire Hathaway look for in a business. Because suppose you steal passwords and you try to do theft for a living. There is no barrier to entry. You are competing every single day against the rest of the planet, and you will do for the rest of your life. There's no way of building a moat or building a wall and saying, you know, I'm going to, you know, create my effective monopoly here. There's no protection for intellectual property. You get a great idea for a keylogger or for some zero day. As soon as you put it out there, everybody else sees it and copies it. You're, you know, no protection. There's no brand loyalty. There's no customer lock-in. There's no contract enforcement, which is, you know, the problem in these underground things. And think of contract enforcement, the most basic tool of commerce. You don't have. It's, you know, this is, So the lack of a barrier to entry, which means open access to resources. And the reason I talk about this one quite a bit is like, I think that this is fundamental to not just the credential stealing business, but it's to kind of all cybercrime stuff, is that, you know, if Usenix security didn't exist and all of us who work on security-related stuff didn't exist, the limiting effect of different bad guys competing against each other will have a limiting effect on their own income, much in the same way that all the guys pulling fish out of the Atlantic and Pacific will limit their catches. You end up with a tragedy of commons when there's no barrier to entry, and anyone who thinks he can make a profit out of it can keep piling in. So by which I kind of mean the following. I mean, here's a quick lesson in competition for, you know, the first guy to come up with the idea of phishing passwords to make money out of it. And he says, well, you know, what is the return on this business? Well, the return is basically kind of, you know, you've got a certain pool of victims and you've got a certain number of phishers doing it, and it's the victims, whatever money you get out of them, divided by the, well, this is great. I mean, the first guy to think of it, making lots of money. Well, but it's so great that, you know, other people notice. They look at these emails coming and say, hey, this is what's going on here. Hey, that's a good idea. Why don't I try that? Well, and as more people try it, what happens here? The denominator in that, you know, average return thing gets smaller and smaller. And if you have a fixed pool of resources and there's nothing blocking more people coming in, you just race to the bottom. You race down to the lowest value, the lowest skill set that can provide this skill. That's, you know, so far so obvious. That's what happens when there's no barrier to entry. But it's actually even worse than that. The tragedy of the commons isn't that the denominator is increasing all the time. The tragedy of the commons is that the numerator starts to decrease. Why does the numerator decrease? The numerator decreases because of the increasing denominator. That is, when you have more and more people trying phishing more and more, you end up with less fish, in the sense that every single one of these guys sending out emails and sending out zero days, you know, causes defensive mechanisms to increase, causes fraud protection at banks to increase, causes users to, you know, realize, hey, all of these mails that I get from banks where I don't have accounts telling me my password is expired, there must be something. It puts people on notice that, so you have the absolute worst economic mechanisms that you could possibly imagine. Your average return is the numerator divided by the denominator. The denominator is increasing as more people pile in because they keep hearing free money, and the numerator decreases because of the very actions of the large pool of people piling in, which just leads me to getting close to wrapping up here, which is me. I really like irony. I really like, and one thing I like to phrase things sometimes if it sounds too good to be true, then it is. This is a piece of advice given by NIST on their webpage, offering advice to end consumers on how to keep themselves and their families safe online. And it's kind of warning them about things like the Nigerian scam and phishing, recruitment, things like that. And it says, if it sounds too good to be true, then it is. And it's a very good piece of advice. And we all know this, and we all give this advice to people. Why don't we observe that piece of advice when we think about people making money out of cybercrime? Because the cybercrime description that I keep hearing, where it's easy money, a guy just goes on some underground forum, he downloads a script, and he makes millions of dollars. That sounds too good to be true, no? I mean, why don't we apply the analysis, you know, the advice that we give to users to the meta phenomenon that we are warning them against. If it sounds too good to be true, then it is. And I think it's as simple as that when it comes to cybercrime. It definitely, I mean, the irony is extreme. So I guess I kind of touched on this already. The thing exists because, you know, they wouldn't be doing this if they weren't making money. Well, I mean, there are many, many, many things in human history where people do suffer long periods of time. And, you know, for those of you who aren't from here, Seattle was the jump-off point for the Klondike. And, you know, I mean, just the stats on it, you know, about in the six, you know, to 12 months after it happened, about 100,000 people left from Seattle heading into the Klondike. About 20,000 of those people actually made it in. About 12,000 of those people ever panned for gold. About 4,000 of them ever found gold. And about 300 of them are believed to have gotten rich by the standards of the day. The total gold extracted from the Klondike was about 50 million by the standards, you know, by the value of gold in the day. The goods sold from Seattle merchants alone to the guys jumping off from here was about 100 million, right? I mean, activity does not imply dollars. It does not. Particularly when information flow is very poor. These guys here, I mean, this picture I think was taken in, October of 1897. So the sad part is here, you know, if you look at these numbers, you would say, I estimated the number of people in this line, and there's about 0.5 of one guy would be one of the ones getting rich here if, you know, you go by the numbers, you know, 300 out of 10,000. Except this picture was taken in October, and, well, actually, pretty much none of these guys are going to get rich because it's already too late and they don't know it yet, right? So it happens all the time that people do stuff not because they're making money from it, because they think they're going to make money from it. And, well, they think they're going to make money from it. Well, where would they get that idea? Well, maybe the same place the rest of us get that idea, right? From all these stories that we hear in the New York Times and Team Cameroon and everyone telling us, you know, that there's billions and billions and billions of dollars in cybercrime. And when we encourage overestimation of returns, we make things worse. We actually recruit people into this fight where they don't make a lot of money for themselves, maybe some tiny percent do, but they generate profound costs and externalities for the rest of us in the form of spam and spam and phishing stuff. And so finally, I wanted to add this, last paper on. Since I talk a lot about the numbers, this was kind of a paper that I had last year on. You know, I finally got so irritated with some of these estimates that I kind of decided to try to, you know, rather than debunk them one by one, try to, you know, go after them wholesale. I don't have time to go into the whole analysis, but again, as I say, I'm a finer, I'm a connoisseur of these fudster attempts. So this is one from, I believe, Norton, $388 billion in cybercrime. And stuff like that, and it's you know, and it's very laid out with all sorts of factoids and that defies any sensible analysis. And the director of the NSA just a couple of weeks ago said cybercrime is the largest transfer of of wealth in history. And I say, well, I'm not sure about that, but I think this is probably the largest transfer of FUD in history. Because, so the $1 trillion, and he actually mentioned a trillion dollar estimate, and there was a good story in ProPublica and Wired just last week chasing down the $1 trillion number. And long story short, it's a wild goose chase of, you know, someone pointing to a report to, you know, no, there's no basis for that. And so, so where do cybercrime estimates come from? Like, we've all heard the, you know, $1 trillion or $280 billion or $100 billion or, you know, big numbers. And where do they come from? Well, they come from surveys. And surveys are good, right? I mean, surveys are, they seem robust. They seem, we kind of figure out who's going to win, you know, elections and stuff like that. And you've heard of surveys being off by, you know, they don't tell you who's going to win the presidential election, but they're not off by huge amounts. So it can't be that bad, right? Well, there's a big difference between numerical surveys and voting surveys. And you know, the estimate, long story short, what goes on in an estimate, the way pretty much every cybercrime estimate that you've seen is formed, is the estimate is, I take some bunch of people, I survey them on, did you lose money in cybercrime? If so, how much? I add them up, and I normalize over the population. I mean, sounds reasonable, does it not? As I say, I'm a fine appreciator of irony. And without going into all the detail, I want to just tell you, there isn't a security person, you know, at this conference who can't, you know, tell you, you should never trust user input, right? You should never trust user input. It is, you know, a great source of, you know, wickedness from SQL injection, buffer overflow, blah, 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 blah. Well, so what's going on here? This, you know, business of, you know, take these numbers, add them up, and I've written this in pseudocode for you. So let's go here. It is total equal to zero. It's for I equal to one to the survey size, and total plus equal to double str copy user input, right? And cast a, so that's what you're doing. You cast a float, you add it in, and then here's the key part here. You multiply by, you know, the normalization factor. So a practice that is unacceptable in writing code. It is unacceptable in writing code. Is ubiquitous. It is the only show in town when it comes to generating those numbers, the $1 trillion number, the $380 billion numbers, the FTC's $50 billion identity tell. It is the only show in town. And it's this. That's what it is. Nothing else. And it's not just in theory that something can go wrong when you ask people, did you lose money? If so, how much? And just, you know, blindly add it in there. And so the FTC did a survey of identity theft, one of these ones that came up with a $50 billion number. And they actually, you know, and this is, you know, by no means the worst offending of these type of surveys. And there were two respondents who between them gave answers, and it was a survey of 5,000 people, which sounds large and blah, 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 representative and all that kind of stuff. Two people who gave numbers out of this $52 billion estimate that accounted for $37 billion of those dollars. Two people. So, and if either of those guys, you know, so here is, you know, here's the total estimate. This is, you know, the portion of the estimate that comes from two guys, And when they drilled into it, they determined, they drilled into these numbers a little further, and they said, well, actually, these guys, one of the guys was just making stuff up, and the other guy wasn't talking about identity theft, it was just something else. So, oops, you know, that's $37 billion that we overestimated the amount. You know, things can go very extremely wrong. So anyway, that's you know, it for me. As I say, you know, kind of a long, you know, multi-part talk, but banks understand non-repudiation. I mean, they understand it very, very well. Look carefully at what they do and what proofs they demand, and you know, you'll find that it's very hard to get things that are irreversible without, you know, delivering good. Passwords are nowhere near being the bottleneck. And you know, it's a shame that some of the good advice that we give to other people, we don't follow ourselves, and we could insulate ourselves from some of this sloppy thinking if we just, you know, would do so. If it sounds too good to be true, then it is. Cybercrime cannot be easy money. That just sounds too good to be true. You should never trust user input, which means, I'm sorry, I hate to be kind of, you know, the party pooper, but, you know, all of the cybercrime estimates you've seen are just junk. I don't mean that they're a little flawed. I don't mean that they're off by 10% or 20% or a factor of two. They're just orders and orders of magnitudes away from being the truth. Always on the high side, never on the low. Anyway, that's it. I've been provocative enough for one afternoon. Other questions, happy to take them.
Not so much of a question, but sort of a comment. After a couple of the recent mass killings, you know, the usual online debates of, God, you know, the U.S. is such a dangerous place compared to the U.K. I forget the number of, like 30,000 gun deaths right next to, you know, driving a car, you know, owning a gun is a very dangerous thing. And somebody says, oh, well, you know, the U.K. is such a better place. And I'm going, well, is it really? So let's compare their populations. And it turns out we have 6 times their population. But if you multiply times the number of gun deaths, we're still way ahead of them by like a factor of 10, mm-hmm. 20, actually. But when I looked at the stats, what really caught my attention was Nigeria. I was just looking at country sizes. Nigeria is the seventh largest country in the world. So when you get a cyber attack from Nigeria, you shouldn't be surprised because there's a lot of people there. That's all. Just a side.
So in the paper about the first passwords are not the bottleneck, you raised an interesting thought that I hadn't thought of, and I was wondering if you could answer it. If this is the case and banks do know so much, why aren't they? So in the UK, for example, there's a lot of work that Professor Anderson did about, you know, banks trying to pull off this trick by giving us chip and PIN.
And the banks just love Ross. They really love
that. Yeah, so but why are they doing that, right? Like, if it's not a problem. And the other one about if they have so much information, why aren't they using it, right? Like, why aren't they selling this fear and being like, hey, just give us $30 a month more and we'll just insure you for everything?
So that's a very good question. I mean, and one thing that I don't have a great answer for is there's a big difference between the way things operate in the US and the way things operate in many banks in Europe. There are many places in Europe where, you know, to do transactions, you know, in, you know, some German banks give people codes, you know, one-time code sheets, and they cross stuff off, and it's all very, very complicated. It's like, so what's different between here and there? And it seems interesting to me that, you know, that the US banks, you know, in using the lower bound in terms of security, which is just passwords, and they offer more or less the upper bound in terms of consumer protection, which kind of says that, maybe in Europe, I mean, once things stay in the US banking system, tracing and reversibility is still a possibility. I mean, I guess cross-border transfers in Europe are far more common than they are in the U.S. I mean, if you try to transfer something from a U.S. bank to something in the Ukraine, it's that's an uncommon thing, right? And that's, every single transaction is probably going to get, a slightly different level of scrutiny. Whereas if you're, say, in Poland or something like that, well, you know, it's probably considerably more common that things go cross-border, and reversibility is a little more difficult. So why do banks in the Europe demand so much more stronger systems? This is a little bit speculation, but I think in the U.S. there's just way more consumer choice when it comes to banking, right? If you're the guy at Wells Fargo who says, okay, enough with this password stuff, enough. We're January 1 next year, everybody's using strong auth, everybody's blah blah blah. Well, some percent of your customers are just going to say, forget it. I'm just gonna either go do physical banking or do phone banking or do you can't afford to take that kind of percent increase in cost. Banks in Europe, I think, they just have, to indulge in some crude, generalizations. In Germany, if you tell people to do it one way, they just do it. I mean, in the U.S., if you tell them to do it one way, they say, no, I'm going somewhere else. I think it's consumer choice mixed. The one thing that I find very puzzling about the U.K. system, and I know Ross, I talked to Ross a bit about this, is that it seems to me that banks in the U.K., if it's really true, as Ross says, that banks in the UK try to stiff consumers with it. One thing, first party fraud does exist. So banks, do have to be vigilant against this. But if banks in the UK are genuinely trying to wriggle out of the ability or the requirement to refund consumers, and the UK protections are probably the worst in Europe, it seems to me that the banks in the UK are actually throwing away a profitable opportunity. Because, shunning liability only makes sense when you don't get compensated for that liability. If you rent a car in the US, the car rental company is dying to take the liability from you for $30 a day, right? Banks, every time I get a bank or a credit card statement, they want to give me identity theft insurance for $12.99 a month, right? When perceived harm is much greater than actual harm, it makes a lot of sense to take the liability and then charge the guy based on the perceived harm, not on the actual harm. And banks know what the harm is, right? We're speculating, they know, right? And when somebody's offering you identity theft at $12.95 a month, you can be pretty sure that it's costing them a lot less. So it seems to me that I buy Ross's kind of argument, but it seems like the banks in Britain are doing things the wrong way. If you've got people more afraid than they need to be, charge them for it. Yes?
You mentioned earlier the market for credit card numbers, and you mentioned that they were selling the credit card numbers at face value. And I was just curious how that came to be, how that was measured. What's the face value of a credit card number?
I think you're referring to one bullet point talking about the $500 for a credit card stuff that at $10 million.
Yeah, I think that was it.
That was from a Team Kumru report, where basically that was what the unsubstantiated, you know, this is somebody saying, I am selling this stuff with face value. Whether he measured that, how he measured that, it's by no means clear that he had any credit cards, that he measured anything. He is simply self-asserting that he is offering something with face value of $10 million for $500. And I was merely pointing out, why would anybody do that, right? Why would, if it's really worth $10 million, why are you giving it to me for $500, right?
So great talk, Komek. So as an additional data point, I want to point out that, you know, in the U.S., when you get a cellular phone, then the idea of having a PIN to unlock the phone is virtually unheard of. I mean, no consumer would actually put up with that. Whereas in Europe, I have a German SIM card and my provider will not even allow me to turn off the PIN request feature. So in Europe, people, when they turn on their phones, first thing they have to do is, you know, to put in a PIN, which sometimes they can't change. That's all settable by the network provider. And in the U.S., you know, does anyone who lives in the U.S. have any kind of lock on their phone that they didn't put on? That's not a network provider lock, but that's just, you know, if you have a dumb phone, then why would you have a PIN?
Yeah, no, it seems that where consumer choice is less, right, that people just, well, they tell me to do it this way, so I do it this way. Whereas in the U.S., there's a lot more of, I don't feel like it.
If AT&T makes me, I move to Verizon, right?
Yeah, exactly.
William Simpson, I have a correction and a question.
Sure.
The correction, I believe when General Alexander was talking about the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of the world, was talking about intellectual property from U.S. companies to non-U.S. companies, not credit card fraud. He is an alarmist in other things, and I was actually at a conference where he announced that we were going to initiate cyber warfare, and he is not one of my favorite people, but nonetheless, I don't think that he was being alarmist about this particular issue.
Well, he said the greatest transfer of wealth in history, and he was talking about intellectual property theft. He cited this $1 trillion number, which came from, I can't remember whether it was a Semantic or McAfee report, and it's basically, you know, a made-up number. It includes a bunch of things. What I was referring to was the source of this, you know, these numbers that we see around cybercrime estimates are not good, right?
And the other thing, the Klondike, it seemed to me that just like then, the real money is in being the provider to the people who want to go out and try their luck at doing the conversion. But those are the people who are causing us the pain. Those are the people sending the spam. Those are the people who are the rippers, as they were saying, selling the credit cards to other people who, or even, you know, taking their money and not even delivering the credit cards. That those middlemen, the guy in from my state of Michigan, who had a lovely house in West Bloomfield. But he was the spam king. He was a middleman. He sold the ability to send out all of those advertisements for mules. And that seems to be the money is, and where the pain is coming to network service providers and even, you know, the common consumer.
It does resemble, I can't remember who mentioned, sort of a multi-level marketing scheme struck me as surprising when you read about the Klondike is, you know, well, if you are buying shovels and stuff from a guy heading into the Klondike, it's like, well, why is this guy wasting his time selling me shovels if it's such a good opportunity? Why doesn't he just take his shovel and go there? And he's been here for a while. Maybe he has better information. When somebody is, one of the things that makes no sense also is like the story of this rich infrastructure to, hey, you don't know anything about phishing, just, you know, here, download some scripts and stuff like that. Well, why would I, if I'm making money at this stuff, why would I, you know, give the tools to people who will act as my competition, unless I have better information than they do about where the true opportunity lies. And I think, I mean, this is, you know, somewhat speculation, but it seems to me the most plausible explanation of what's going on is there's this long tail phenomenon. There are people at the top who are definitely making good money. The people who are making good money are the people who are providing infrastructure and who are preying on, I mean, it is a very predatory kind of a business in that there's a steady supply of new entrants who are very poorly informed, who and common to multi-level marketing schemes like drug pushing, where the street dealers make very little, or things like Amway and Mary Kay, where the people coming in at the bottom, they're the main source of the money, right? They you know, their money to bootstrap what they think is going to be a business for them is what feeds some of the upper layers who know better what's going on. The damage that it's doing, yeah, I think, I mean, I'm good at pointing out anomalies. I wish I could say, and here's a comprehensive picture about how we fix all this. Sorry, I'm not that guy. This ain't that talk.
But are there good numbers on the actual damage, the cost to ISPs of the increase in spam in their networks? I mean, I know once upon a time when I owned an ISP, in 2003, we had to triple the size of our incoming pipes. And we weren't getting, you know, new customers. It was just the incredible influx of spam after August, I guess it was, 2003. Yeah. So there's a tremendous cost to us as businesses and infrastructure, and we need good estimates on that, because that would drive good estimates on what it costs, that how much money we should be spending on security researchers. This is all tied together.
No, absolutely. I mean, to take the suspense out of your question, no, I don't think we have such good estimates, and I think, you know, but it would be a good start to try to form them. But I mean, I think one of the bad, I mean, sometimes I think, you know, people get the impression when I give a talk, oh, you're that guy who goes around saying it's all no big deal, right? And yeah, it's not that I don't think it's a big deal, I think it's a very big deal. I think the big deal is just something other than what, you know, we've offered this how much bad guys are making as a proxy for the size of the problem. That's a profound mistake. The size of the problem is the harm that it's doing to users and the harm to businesses, and we haven't really made a serious effort to measure that. Yes.
Some of the points you made reminded me of the book Freakonomics by Levitt and Dubner.
Yep.
And there, they had the question. I mean, everybody thinks that a drug dealer is making a lot of money, right? So I'm talking about the drug dealers that are going onto the streets and really selling drugs, right? So low doses of drugs. And they had the question, if drug dealers make that amount of money, so a lot of money, why are they still living with their parents? Because most of them are still living with their parents.
The mother, I think,
And the reason what they find out was that they don't earn a lot of money, especially not for the risk they are taking, because there's a serious amount of these people die per year because they get shot in a gunfight or so, or they get convicted, or they get drug addicted by themselves, for example, right?
Yep.
And this reminded me what you were saying about those people who are cashing in credit card numbers, for example. So they take a credit card and try to make some money out of it, right? And I think I agree with you. So I believe you that this is not a very good business model. So really, cashing in credit card numbers is not a big. You don't get a lot of revenue from this. But in the Freakonomics book, what the people were saying that there are very few people earning a lot of money from selling drugs, and there are many people taking a lot of risk and earning less money, right? And the less money part that we have seen from you right now. And my question is, do you recognize any few people who are making a lot of money from this? Like the mafia, for example, or really big truck cartel or so?
I would be kind of, you know, speculating more than I already have. In the drug thing, I think it's fairly clear that, you know, there's a long tail. And like, why don't the guys, you know, on the bottom, you know, make any money? Because there's no reason to pay them any money, right? Because there's an oversupply of people who are willing to do this task. As a matter of fact, you don't have to pay them any money, you pay them in kind. They're all addicted to whatever it is they're selling, so you just give them an ounce per week of whatever it is, and that's, you know. But the drug business definitely has this, you know, has this head of the distribution, which makes a lot, because there's a long, complex chain that takes stuff from, you know, hillsides in South America and gets it across the border, and there's a lot, and there's demand for the product, right? There's demand for drugs. So there's a, you know, the estimates that you see of how much the drug traffic is worth are probably exaggerated also, but there's clear demand for this product. Whereas the total amount of money in cybercrime stuff is, you know, is it's orders of magnitude smaller than drug stuff because there's no demand for the product. There's no demand for people to have their money stolen. But And it's orders of magnitude smaller than the estimate. So I don't know at the head of the distribution, right? I mean, the drug distribution thing really needs some kingpins who can organize that stuff, getting it across borders and things like that. You know, password stealing, there's probably some people who are doing well, but I don't think you're going to find guys like in Colombia where they've got, you know, where they essentially make more money than the government or so. It's probably not as peaked a distribution as that at the top, would be my guess, but I'm speculating. Anyway. So it sounds like we're more or less out of questions. Thank you very much. Sorry if I provoked you more than you can take. Thank you.